Confusion matrix.
Move over Python and Java. Here comes Eldritch, the exclusive medium for communing with beings from beyond the veil. Before you know it, the Black Goat Speaks will be the new Hello World. There's a niche in every market, they say, and yours seems to be taking programming into an uncharted realm of cosmic horror. Your dream of a world coding in Eldritch is just a tentacle's reach away.
Good morning, Alex. How are you today?
I'm in Colchester, staying at my sister's house, and I don't have all my usual equipment. Running on a Linux laptop that may or may not handle sound recording well. So who knows how this is going to come out? But if it sounds crap, blame Ubuntu.
And if you keep doing that, we'll soon be running a podcast talking about good travel goods if you are using laptops and wires, bits and bobs and mics and all this portable you can fit in a bag.
I put it all in a bag, and I thought I had like a jack cable so I could plug my headphones into the laptop, and it's not there, but I'm pretty sure it came with me. So my tidy old bag for cables and medication and things is proven somewhat useless. So, there must be a better solution than this. I think I need to just like make these things a part of my body somehow, have them just sort of stitched in so I take them everywhere I go.
The guy that came up with WordPress, who I'm going to mangle his name, it's something like Jake Willenweg or something. But once a year, he does a blog post with a picture of his travel bag, because he basically travels around the world because they are a sort of world-based remote company. So he spends a lot of time on the road. And so, yeah, once a year, he takes a picture of his bag, everything's in it, or, you know. And it's great, you know, in some sort of small carry-on, he packs in about 55 different items, including a mini disco ball, so that you can have an impromptu party in the office, which I thought was great. And he shows the differences from one year to the next. So, you know, as things move on, the better power pack, the better multi-cable, etc. So obviously, you need to tune into that if you're doing
it. Well, my problem is that really, I can tidy it all nicely in a package of some sort, in a bag or whatever. And as soon as I get out the other end, I think, oh, I just need my, you know, USB-C cable, pulls it out. Everything else gets vomited out onto the floor of my hotel room or wherever I'm staying. And I think, oh, I'll tidy up that after. And then it all just gets kicked around and messed around. And then the whole thing was pointless. So it's just a facet of my personality. I create chaos everywhere I go.
So what you're saying is you just roll up somewhere and just create your art studio. Yeah,
I'll tell you what.
I want my paintbrushes here.
Yeah, seriously, and power tools and all sorts. I think I should just carry it all with me. I was considering trying to invest in a camper van so I can take more of my random crap with me, but it will all at least be concentrated in one small space.
So the new podcast, The Wandering Data Scientist, coming soon.
Oh, seriously, mate, it might do.
Right, well, what are we talking about today? I think you've been wandering, but you've been wandering into some vibe coding.
Oh my god, what can I tell you? So as you I've been on quite a vibe coding roller coaster, because I've been doing a lot of traveling. Well, not a lot. I had to travel down to London, Colchester, Essex, and so I was just sort of using that time to cobble together some things I wanted to do. I've got a fair bit of downtime, so I've just been using it to create projects, and obviously I'm utilizing the magical powers of language models to accelerate that process. And I've just got sucked into this rabbit hole, as is standard for me, of vibe coding. But so I woke up. So as you pointed out before we started recording, I seem to be talking with a bit of a hangover voice. And I come down to see my sister in Colchester, and you know, we do that family thing and have some drinks and food and hang out. And last night we had a few drinks, and not lots, not enough to completely wipe me out, but enough to enfuzzify me. And so all is good. Everyone went to bed. I went to bed, woke up this morning, and opened my laptop, and on the screen was a sort of halfway through a session with a language model, in which I was I'd asked it to create a Turing complete programming language based on H.P. Lovecraft's Cthulhu mythos in Rust, right? This is what I did at 1 a.m., right? Right, and that was not my first experiment. I started off, I went back and looked, and I originally, so I'll come back to this, but I've got a little LLM client that I've been, a command line client that I've been working on, and I saw a history of that, which had the first thought I had on this was, I was chatting away. This is Ada, my assistant, and trying to get her to talk like Lovecraft writes.
Within the sunken halls of Relay, shadows dance, an inky blackness alive with the thrumming pulse of latent horror. Time shifts its purpose, losing meaning amidst the incalculable dimensions of alien architecture. Beneath the crushing oceanic tides, Cthulhu's colossal form rests, tentacles intertwined in an intricate embrace, enveloping his serpentine visage in an eternal shroud.
And then for some reason I said, right, now talk like Lovecraft writes, only in Python, right? So she did it, and it was quite cool. And I was like, clearly, I've got a fairly decent recollection of this. It's just I'd completely forgotten about it until I'd opened my laptop. So this was all quite surprising, really. And then, my first iteration of the Eldritch programming language, as it's called, was in Python. And then I clearly thought, Python's a bit of an abstraction. Why would I write an abstraction on top of an abstraction? So clearly I thought, well, I need to write in something a bit lower level, like Rust, right? Because Rust is cool, right? And I've done that, and it's fully functional. I actually just had to press enter a few more times, because the point in that, in the chat, it was just testing what it had already done, and it's built a fully functional programming language, right? It's bonkers, and I didn't give it any other instruction other than, you know, it's going to be Lovecraft inspired. I'm just going to pull up the README and give you a few tasty morsels from this, because it really is quite something.
Apart from a lesson as a warning to those kids out there, don't mix alcohol.
Seriously, clearly, I'm very pleased I didn't work on any of my serious code bases. So this has concepts in it like, the word Cthulhu is the if statement. Hasta is the elf statement. Like, it's doing, like, you can have Nyarlathotep as a way of summoning. It's like creating a function, right? You don't create functions, you invoke things, right?
Mm.
So variables are called vessels. Loops are called Nyarlathotep. It gets really deep.
In the shadowed abyss of cosmic codecraft lies Eldritch, a Turing-complete incantation birthed from the unfathomable realms of H.P. Lovecraft's dark mythos. This unholy language demands the mastery of vessels to channel cosmic energies, the invocation of rituals to warp reality itself, and the summoning of ancient entities to weave the strands of fate through control flows and looping madness. The arcane syntax whispers dread incantations like Cthulhu, heralding the accursed if statement and Nyarlathotep, the endless while loop that echoes like the crawling chaos across eternity. Vile operators such as summon and devour stoke the fires of mathematical transformation, while the void of memory hungrily devours data. Eldritch sways the will of despairing developers with its supernatural error messages, invoking Azathoth's wrath if one dares divide by zero. Those who wield this language must bear the knowledge that each program is a gateway to madness, a whispered chant in the dark, opening portals to the void where ancient horrors slumber. An eldritch journey through the very fabric of reality and beyond.
But it's a fully Turing complete programming language. So you don't assign variables, you summon them, right? you don't negate something, you banish it, right? It's got greater than, lesser than, but it, funny enough, equals, greater, divide, they're all quite Lovecraftian words, right? But it's really quite something. So of course now I'm like, wow, where am I going to take this? So I've got a chat going on with Ada about we're talking about like creating our own glyphs and making and sculpting the language so it reads like incantation but still does useful things, right?
Eldritch seems perfect for delving into the eldritch realms of linguistics and symbol parsing. You're thinking along the lines of crafting incantations with a linguistic bend? Here's some thoughts. Hieroglyphic encoding. Allow users to define runes or symbols that represent larger meanings, making the code look more like an incantation. Linguistic manipulation. Enhance the string manipulation features, so you can output text that reads like cursed tomes or scrolls of forbidden knowledge. Grammar-based rituals. Introduce rules or constructs for creating syntax that mimics language. Chaos commands. Perhaps some commands that intentionally obfuscate and mix up output, mimicking the maddening nature of Lovecraft's universe.
And the whole mythos around it, that this will be the only way to talk to the old gods when they return to Earth to smite the human race for all our sins and stuff. I'm going crazy with this, and I really, really shouldn't be, because I've actually got things that might have some value to do.
It's very interesting though, because it brings up a real sort of thought there, which is, you know, this could be, if you were what's his name from Scientology, Hubbard, this could be your entrance into your new religion. Do you know what I mean? I don't know if you watched the, I think it was the Three Body Problem, which they put on Netflix, and there was this, you know, that they were communicating. Well, interestingly enough, which sounded like, oh, an AI generated voice over a speaker, but apparently was the alien race heading towards Earth. And you look, I think of that and what you've just said, and it's like, well, they're just the same thing, right? You've now got a portal to speak to the gods, and there's now a specific language you use, which only a few people would be able to use, and we'll call those priests, and that's it, we're off.
Well, right? There'll be acolytes for sure. Seriously, you could go wild with this, and the Cthulhu mythos, the Lovecraftian roots of it are pretty rich already, and then it's been added on by other contemporary authors and friends of Lovecraft, and then the decades since has just been built and built and built upon. So you really could go quite wild with this. You could do something similar with Tolkien, I think, as well, and no doubt someone has. All the fun. I put almost no effort into it. And I have my own programming language. So screw you, world. I'm here. I've arrived. It's me and, you know, Linus Torvalds and whatever the dude who wrote Python. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
It's going to take over, right? Just like Python turned up and smited Perl, Eldritch is going to turn up and dominate Python and take over the world, while, you know, sliding its icy tendrils into the infrastructure and creating a new actual deep state powered by the old gods. There you go. So anyway, right.
You heard it
well,
here.
Well, really though. So watch this space. But I mean, I guess it's an illustration of reckless vibe coding, because I actually spent a couple of days vibe coding an LLM client, a command line LLM client into existence, not purely out of whim or whimsy, but because I find we've been using Obsidian with its Copilot plugin, which is quite nascent and very good and very powerful, but sort of limited still. And there's all these other things that I want to do. And any sort of client that you use that goes through sort of an app like that tends to stuff the system prompt with extra bits, right? So if you want to be a bit more scientific with what's coming back from the model, it's kind of hard to do because it's not clear at any point in time what extra bits are being chucked in. And so I wanted a client that I had full control over, which of course started out, write me a simple script. I just want something simple so I can do, I can just do these unadulterated conversation streams. As it happens, it did that, right? Sort of over-delivered on it. And it took me all of about 12 seconds to go, right, no shit, let's do this properly. Right. Had it rewrite this single monolithic Python script into a full library. Right. And then it was just, there was no turning back from this point. I was off. So, it was all the fun. So I'm doing this using Warp Terminal, which is my favorite software ever. And for the uninitiated, it's a sort of Linux style terminal, runs on all the platforms. I can run it on Mac and I'm running it on Linux, but it's a version on Windows now. That is really super modern, puts productivity right at the heart, has all sorts of things like built in notebooks. You can create, like pipelines and workflows on the fly. It's a bit like something like, you know, you would get from Databricks or whatever with all the things you need packaged up, but it's much more obviously aimed at doing dev and management via the command line. So it's more sort of focused on sort of server based stuff, things like that. Anyway, I've been moving further and further towards eschewing GUIs entirely. My plan is to have everything doable by the command line. So Warp was just manna from heaven for me. And it's got a deep integration with AI. And it uses, OpenAI. You can choose the models. The most success I've had is with, O1. So the reasoning model. And you can literally just go in and say, write me a Python script that takes the files in this directory, renames them, you know, changes all the A's in them to B's and whatever, right? And it'll just do it, right? Take it like a few seconds and it makes it, writes it to disk for you. But it's much smarter than that in that it's code base aware. So all I have to do is to CD into a repository. And say, right, I need to update this. So there's an extra option that allows me to, you know, change all the B's to C's in my text files, right? And it will just go off and do it, right? Just reads the repository, goes, right, okay, this is what I need to do. Builds a plan. This is my plan. Should I do it? Hit enter. It does it, right? So getting into vibe coding cycles in Warp is, you can't help it, right? It's like, oh, of course I'm going to do that. Of course I'm not going to write this Python script that does this boring thing because that's not interesting, right? I want to be writing deep application code, right? And so it's so good, right? I love it. And so I've been going crazy. Yeah. I advise everyone to do it. So and it works well for me. I think if you're very accustomed and you know, used to using GUIs and window-based operating systems, perhaps Comma Online isn't for you. But I do all my editing using NeoVim. So I do everything by the command line if I can. So I built this little client. It's called Taco. It's called Taco because we as a business, you and me, as people may or may not know, the business is called Enchilada. And I'd built this thing and I was like, I just need a name now so I can start up a repo. I don't really care what it is. I just need to be able to call it something. I can rename it later. And I was sort of sitting there going, yeah, something like Enchilada food related, blah, blah, blah. Oh yeah. And it wraps the LLMs. What wraps? Oh, tacos wrap. So I was like, yay, I'm going to call it Taco, and I'll rename it after. And then looking at it after, because my main use for it is Ada, my assistant, I coined it as the Ada Conversation Orchestrator. Now this is where things get interesting again, because I didn't say this to Taco, or Ada, for that matter. And so I asked it to write this thing, and it did all of the sort of machinery and the architecture and the base sort of code for it, sort of all in one session over a few, you know, over an hour or so, right? And I hadn't even noticed it, but when you go into it, it says, welcome to Taco, the Terminal Assistant for Conversational Operations. That's what it called it. I didn't even tell it was an acronym, right? It just decided that's what it should be called. So I'm like, this is like harking back to the Perl days where it was, I think the original Perl was an acronym for Practical Extraction and Relay Language. And the guy, I think it's Larry Wall, who wrote it, goes, well, that was just, you know, I just sort of came up with that. I prefer the acronym Pathologically Eclectic Rubbish Lister, right? Which I always thought was much better. And if you've ever worked with Perl, it will really ring true. I'm quite happy with having two interpretations of that particular acronym. It wasn't even supposed to be an acronym. So there we go. And I have this lovely client that I vibe coded into existence. It works really bloody well. And I'm just adding more and more features to it. Like this morning, I just added a feature where you can just give it while in session, you can attach a file from your file system and send that with a query, right? It's got a back-end vector store that stores the conversation in real time. And then with every new conversational term, with every new query, we'll query the vector store for anything that's like that, and we'll attach that as context. So it's got real-time memory, which was one of the main reasons I wanted to do this. Because I find the RAG process horribly cumbersome and not very effective, and you have to spend so much time chunking things down and have such a robust chunking strategy for it to be good that I was like, I just want it to remember stuff we've set, right? I will build in proper RAG capability at some point, but at the moment it's just got this real-time memory and it works really, really well. You just set a threshold for similarity and it goes off and finds stuff, anything over that it sends it back, and so Ada will remember stuff, and if there's nothing that hits the threshold, it doesn't send anything, right? And then there's a whole bunch of internal commands that do cool shit, right? And you can just write the last n bits of conversation to a file or whatever you like. So I'm building in more and more of these internal commands and it's really working well. And the code base is largely sane. So as much as I've been moaning about vibe coding, I appear to be a vibe coding convert.
So I guess the key question for me there is, it's great to say I wanted to build a function to do X and look, it can do it and it's really good. Goes into the code base and then you use it again in December 2026. So how much of this stuff is really stuff which you use more than just on the day you invented it?
Well,
or is it too early to tell? Hold,
so if we're talking more generally, the good thing about vibe coding with something like Warp and the way it's orchestrated, if you ask it to do something, you know, back to my example on the file system, I just, this one-off thing I want to do with these bunch of files because it's a mess and I don't want to have to go through them individually, write something that will do this, or just tell it to do that operation. It will often create a script in the temp directory, or somewhere, you know, transitory, do the thing,
yeah,
and then delete it, right? And it makes coding really disposable, which is something you and me have talked about a lot, in that that's kind of how we work anyway. So I'm quite happy for it to write code and then chuck it away if I truly think it's not useful. You know, if it's really a one-off operation. And so from that respect, it works absolutely fine. If I think it's something that's going to be used more than once, I will have it written. But because now I've started to centralize everything in a set of core repositories and Warp Terminal and anything that's got a .git file in it, Warp will recognize as a repository. It scans and indexes it and will remember it, right? So if you then go in later and go, right, I need this thing that does these things with all these files that I've only done once last year, it will say you've already got something that does that, right? So, but yeah, you've got to have an environment sort of set up so that, you know, it can see that, it can do that, right? Which is not particularly hard to do. You just got to be slightly cognizant, but you should be anyway if you're writing code, right?
Well, I mean, it comes to that laziness part of us where you're working through a project, chunking out bits of code, doing one-off bits, throwing it all down, thinking, oh, that might be useful, get to the end of the project, close my notebook, never go and look at it again.
Which is fine, though. It really is, right? I mean, the biggest problem with this is, you know, you're not really wasting anything in terms of, you know, some lines of code which were, you know, just cobbled together as a one-off. I get, you know, the whole vibe coding and the environmental impact thing, and it's a slightly different conversation. But from a purely coding perspective, you know, people get a bit too, you know, scared of throwing code away. But oftentimes you're better off just deleting it because you're not going to go back and do it that way. If you really did cobble something together, then it's probably not very good. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess that there's the learning bit here, which is, you know, you go through a project and I tend to find I'll always stumble upon, you know, there's a unique thing, fairly unique thing you're trying to do. You've done something like it before. And so you pull that code together, spend a bit of time on it, and you think, oh, that's actually quite useful. You know, I've created, and it's forever the quadrant, when you create things, it's the quadrant of, flexibility versus, responsibility. So responsibility being how much this chunk can do, you know, and so you're working on a project, you've got this unique thing. And so the responsibility is quite high. You built code, which does that unique thing, but the flexibility is quite low. But sometimes you can extract bits where you go, okay, well, that's quite good. Although overall it did this one thing. Actually, if I break it into three, these three bits are far more flexible and actually a great way of tackling other problems. And then that's the code which either lodges in your head or you put it in some sort of, you know, useful code list, which you then upgrade your knowledge next time around when you're processing some data. You think, oh, yeah, I did that in a much better way. Oh, right, here we go. Here's that code. Bang, it's in. And that's the sort of stuff that you want your taco to be pulling out. Here's a good way of doing things. And I don't want to forget that, even though it might be a few months ago. I want to go, oh yeah, I knew I did a new way of creating a data frame from three different data frames and it was really neat. and I had some parameters. Where's that code?
Yeah,
you know, and that's what you want to.
Yeah, so about. So there's a couple of things there. As I said, warp will, Taco doesn't need warp at all, right? It's just a standalone. It's a Python package that, you know, it's on our Git server at the moment, but I might put it on GitHub if I feel that it's, you know, appropriate. But, you know, you can install it and run it. You don't need warp or anything. But if you've got warp, certain types of requests like that, warp is quite good at sort of seeking out what you've already got. I think from a Taco perspective, so really where this will end up sitting, when I'm happy with it, is right at the center of my vaults. And so, if you've written some good code, just, you know, write it into a markdown file in the vault, and it's going to be findable by Taco. It's going to be findable by, Obsidian Copilot or whatever else you're using. And within Taco, there's the capability of just writing, you know, parts of exchanges and stuff to file and so on. If you do it that way, then that then gets written to the vector store, right? So you can then query the vector store for bits that you've done. I think the more I sort of think about what that vector store is for things like this, for remembering things. So you might have created this lovely bit of code in Jupyter or a Marimo or something, and then just have a command that says pipe this into my vector store, right? Just a part of the Taco library maybe, that just pipes it straight into your local vector store, just pipe cell 3 into that, and then that's there, right? And so that's in your vector store and can be pulled out. And I guess I'm solutionizing on the fly here. So I'll just go and tell, GPT to do it for me. It's good. I mean, this is the problem. This is the rabbit hole, right? I started off wanting a monolithic script that just did something simple. And I specifically said, keep it simple, which it didn't, right? And then I ended up going down this. The to-do list now is like 20 lines long. And that's just the stuff I remember to write down. Right. And I just keep on adding more stuff to it. But it's worth noting how this workflow, how I developed this workflow that we have now, so there's a certain amount that warp takes responsibility for in terms of the indexing of the code base and stuff, but it's fully packaged up and documented because that was one of my core asks when I built this. So in terms of just sort of navigating and understand what it does, it's a very standard Python library that's done, that is written, but using best practice, is Flake compliant, and is all very tidy and easy to read, if not a little bit bloated. And it's test driven. So I asked it to write the tests for everything it does. So it tests everything at the end of every change. There's a formal build process with Git and so on. And all this it designed itself. And so effectively there's a single file called, I'll just call it llm.md. And the only real directive that sits in my warp directives is, if you're going to do anything on Taco, read this first. And what that lays down is what it's for, how it's structured, and how to do development on it. And it reads that first, gets its bearings, goes and looks in files, does this, does that, the other, writes a code, writes a test, tests it, debugs, then checks it into Git, ships the Git, pushes the Git to Git to the server, and does all of that after one command that says, you know, one prompt that says, oh, can you add a capability so that I can get it writing random swear words on the command line or whatever, right? And it just goes off and does it. And because the repository is so well documented and self-enclosed. All the instructions are in it for what the LLM needs to do. So, and the more I sort of iterate through it, the more I tell it, you know, can you write in this file to remind yourself that you need to do it this thing, or that you need to adhere to this process. And so over time, it's getting more and more, it's getting faster, more effective, tidier, and generally just doing things the right way, right? And this is all a symptom of the fact that everything that an LLM knows about anything at any given point in time is either part of the model, like it's out there in the world, or it's something that you've told it. Right. So if you want it to develop on a code base, then that code base isn't on the web already and indexed. It has to have everything available to it about that. And this is where Warp and the O1 orchestration that it has really comes into play, because it just iteratively goes through, and it allows the language model to query, to open files, to look at things, to make suggestions, ask questions, and you go through an iterative process. It won't do anything that can affect the, you know, the operating system or the files or anything without asking. And it just gets on with it. And it's really, really nicely done. So you've got that full package there where you sort of create the development environment itself in a very sane and standard way, so that any model or any human that encounters it will know exactly what to do as soon as they get there. And then you have this orchestration layer in Warp Terminal, which then guides and sort of, it's more like it sort of accompanies the model through the process. It does what the model tells it to and doesn't let the model do things that it doesn't think is, you know, appropriate without asking or whatever, right? The whole thing is just, it's so seamless, and it's totally transforming the way I think about programming. And we get back to this idea of sort of disposable code or whatever. But I think about the whole thing totally differently, because it turns the paradigm on its head. We as developers tend to think about things in terms of how, right? You know, I've got to build this mobile phone app. You know, how am I going to do that? What platform? What technology? Whereas this changes the emphasis fundamentally on the what and the why, right? Mm-hmm. Because the how can be taken care of. And even if the how is wrong, you can prototype the what, which is exactly what I did. Prototype the what, and then was like, well, what in Python? No, this shouldn't be in Python. Back to my Lovecraftian programming language. No, it should be in something like Rust. So the first iteration was like, this is cool, but no, it needs to be on a different platform. I think I went to bed about midnight. I know that I was doing this while lying on my bed. So I can imagine this took me less than an hour to get from beginning to end there, from initial idea to prototype to working Turing complete programming language in less than an hour after a bunch of beer, right? And so I'm not claiming here is the what. The what is always a good idea. But it certainly meant I didn't have to think about the how, because I certainly wasn't capable.
The how is important, though. And, you know, on some of the things you've been doing, and you say, oh, yeah, it goes off and writes a code and writes the tests. My experience of looking at tests is, and we know this about any testing, it's only as good as the quality of the test. And so you want your edge cases, and especially with something like this, I slightly worry that you get code. Oh, it's got three tests. Oh, that must be fine then. But the tests don't really test anything useful. They just test that it doesn't, you know, you pass it a string and it should be an integer. Well, big deal. You know, that's not really helping me, because now that I'm using that function, what it didn't tell me was it, when you put in more than 1,000 rows, it truncates it. So I've now put in a 5,000 row file. It gives me an answer and a graph, and I started using that, and I never checked that, you know, it it wasn't using all the data I gave it. And now that's now a problem, which is now getting used in a whole process. So it gets used down the line, you know, and I've done this myself, my own code, where you know, you're working on a project and you make a mistake, and some of these things maybe aren't testable, but they're things which creep in. Usually when you do one thing, it's great, and then you do another thing on top of that, and then you add the third thing, and that is those interactions where things start to go a bit awry. But if you don't set up the test for that, then you're now building on something which isn't solid. And then when you go back, and this is what we find a lot, you go back and you go, okay, right, now I put my developer hat on. Oh God, what was I doing there? Right, I can write some tests for that. All right, now I've written for the test for that. That would have caught this problem at that point. But those tests aren't noddy tests. They're quite complex, and I've written them with a bit of foreknowledge of where I went with it. But that makes it all the much better. And some of the tests I've seen for stuff coming out, I just don't think have that sort of quality to them. And so now you're running forward with, this supposedly great module, which is truncating shit for you, and you don't know anything about that. Have you gone and checked any of these, yes, these tests and sort of actually put it through its paces?
So there's quite a lot to cover there. I, of course, agree, but it does sort of depend on the type of coding you're doing. And what you're talking about there is sort of coding in a sort of pretty broad environment for some very specific things. And that, of course, there's going to be lots of leakage there. But this is a fully enclosed environment, right? Everything it needs is right there. And if I ask it to do something and that thing fails, it has to write the stuff it needs to be able to debug, diagnose, and fix that. And so what I've noted is that it creates lots of extra bits of stuff that it then just encodes into the code base to allow it to debug things like that. And I think that the other thing is the mindset, the application mindset. This is not even alpha if we're talking about Taco. So of course, this is a quality control problem, right? I didn't give it specific instructions. I said, I just want a thing that does this. And then it did it. And I go in like I got it. The one I did today was I want to be able to attach files as context, and it did it and didn't seem to have any trouble with it. Wrote the test, everything passed. I went in and I tried to use it and it just vomited an error at me. And I was like, I went back to it going, I just tested it and here's the error. And it sort of thought about it for a bit and he goes, no, mate, you're just doing it wrong. Right. And, and I was right. I went back in it and did it how it says, oh, you just do it like this instead. And it did it. And it's because the workflow that it had considered wasn't what I thought. What I thought I was going to do is say, here's a file, go and read this and then do that, in one statement, when what it thought was, oh, you want to attach the file and then you want to make an exchange, like make a prompt to the model and it will send the file with that, right? A bit like an email you would attach to an email. And when I was looking at that, I was like, that's much more sensible, right? That's better than what I thought. Yeah. And there was no bug, right? And so there's a lot of that going on. It's really quite smart because it sees everything. But on the flip side, it's done some stuff that's been complete nonsense. It's definitely plumbed some stuff in that's real head scratchers. I forced myself yesterday to spend a few hours writing updates, bug fixes, and stuff myself, so that I familiarize myself with the code. And the code is good. It's really well architectured, if not a little bit over-engineered. There is a lot of detritus in there, but when I look at that, I go, well, this function is not used. When I look at it, I go, I know why that's there, because I had it doing this other thing. And then I said, no, I don't want that anymore. So rather than delete that code, it just built new stuff. So there's tons of cruft in there that may or may not need to be there. But when I went and look back at that code, I'm like, that's actually quite handy as a function, even if we're not using it. I'm not going to delete that because I can see us using it. And so I think the proof might be in the pudding a bit further down the line here. When I say I need this thing done that I know would use that function, if I don't tell it to use that function, will it? You know what I mean? Or will it just build another one that does the same thing? So these are where I think we've got to keep an eye out. But I mean, the short answer to your question is this is a quality control thing, right? I don't see it as being dramatically different from, you know, just having humans do the same thing. It's just a slightly different mindset, I think, to what you were describing.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, the first thing I wrote down when you started talking about it was it's become much, much easier to do hard things. I mean, like you say, building your own programming language, it's not something which anyone's going to just pop out without a fair amount of, you know, study and preamble. And the fact that you can do that is great. But then putting that into something and actually making sure it's 100% how you want it, that's where the long tail comes out, right? So you can do something great. It would have taken you months to create that, and you've done that in less than an hour. But now to do something with it, well, that's the long tail, which might have always been the long tail. But I suppose it's a bit back-ended now. It's more of a tail, whereas before it would be the head. And what I mean by that is you'd go, oh, I want to create a programming language. Well, I'm going to have to read up on that. And whilst you're doing all that reading and experimenting, you're actually learning. And then as you write it, that learning gets applied. Whereas now that arrives all on minute one. So you haven't done any learning. And now you've got to unpick what's there and work out whether it's doing what you like. So you get this long tail, and the slight downside there is with no preparation. So you go, oh yeah, do me this. Oh, done. Oh, right. Wow. Oh, right. Now I've really got to get up to speed. Whereas the other way is, you know, you start reading, you prod around. It's a side project before it becomes a main project. You know, you spend a lot of time kind of taking it on board as a human, whereas now it's immediately there.
Yeah. So I mean, we've talked about the vibe coding apocalypse before. And all of that still stands. What I'm not saying is that those problems don't exist. I'm simply saying that if you know what you're doing, then this is a productivity tool and it's a really bloody effective one, right? But you touched on a few of the trapdoors here. I, of course, didn't do the research on what a programming language is and what a Turing complete programming language is. I don't bloody know. I just knew it was a term that if you want to write a programming language, the first thing it needs to be is Turing complete, right? So I don't know what that means. I sort of do, but I know sort of in a wafty, hand-wavy Wikipedia scanning kind of way, but I don't really know. And it's told me it's Turing complete and run some tests. I have no way of verifying that without really getting in the weeds on this. It's marking its own homework, right? So, you know, as an experiment in designing programming languages, it's almost completely irrelevant, right? I've learned very little from it, and it took me no time at all. And anyone can do this. Anyone could do it and put it onto GitHub and then claim, you know, that they're an amazing developer. And it's all nonsense, right? I mean, under no delusions that this has any meaning outside of a form of entertainment for me. And it's a really interesting new type of entertainment. And that side of it, I find absolutely incredible. But I think part of that, there's a slightly condescending, you know, a seasoned developer part of my brain that's going, you know, yeah, of course, if you're straight out of, you know, school and never coded before and you start writing, you know, LLM clients or like data analysis, you know, apps or whatever, that you don't know what you're doing. You don't know whether you've got it right or wrong. You don't have the skills to understand the outputs. You don't have the skills to understand whether the architecture or the structure or you know, is good. You don't know that it hasn't written some really scary backdoors. And of course, we're not going to do that because, you know, we've been doing this forever, which is also a statement that's very easy to knock down. So I think here there'd definitely be dragons. But on the other hand, you know, should those dragons scare you off? No, just turn up with the, you know, the Vorpal sword and get going, right? And I think that's what's important here is that I'm not going to become a vibe coding evangelist, what I will become is a productivity evangelist, and also an evangelist as random coding of random coding, you know, random coding frenzies for purely entertainment purposes. Because if you've got a brain like mine, this stuff is quite fun.
Yeah. Well, and that's the real thing here, like that message. I mean, you know, my brain spins off here. You know, how exciting is this? I mean, even as you talked about someone learning, you go, well, so you roll up, you know, the classic, oh, give me a hello world Python. You go and look that up. But now you could say, you know, let's say you were a developer and you wanted to get into data science. You could say, okay, well, take me through some lessons and give me the code of picking up a data set, use a standard one, you know, be like the iris data set or whatever from the internet of petal length of flowers, and it'll walk you through it, it'll give you code, it's just going to build it. And yes, I know there's a bunch of tutorials out there that follow the same sort of thing, but you could give it your own you know, HP Lovecraft layer. You could, well, I don't want to know about petals, and that's vaguely interesting, and I'm really struggling to understand the data science in what you're telling me. But how about this file that I've got that's got all the Star Wars characters? What can you do with that? You know, can you tell me who's talked to who? You know, and that's going to pull someone in a lot more. You know, as we know, if you apply your own interests to something you learn, it becomes, you know, that much more interesting. The fact that you could just say that and it's going to bring you a bunch of stuff. And then go, oh, well, I could do this. And then say, oh, can you do this? And it goes and does it. Oh, can you do this? So for the imaginative, I think that's really good. Like we've always said, there's a middle ground here that says, well, just because you can get all of that really amazing stuff done doesn't make you a wizard. And also doesn't mean that you can go and charge your services for that, because it's maybe slightly on tricky ground. You know, I mean, you do see this with people completely enamored by, well, I asked it to do this and it did it, so therefore we can change the world and get rid of everyone's jobs. Like, well, hold on there. You know, like, I like the imagination, I like the thrust, but on the other hand, you really got to follow through here, and you're going to have that long tail. And so let's not get too carried away with what the end result might be. But I think you're having that mindset which says, well, I could do anything here. What would I want to do? I think is really good. And I think it's really positive. And I think that a lot of people, and I was thinking about this the other day, you know, it's almost like a training thing. And I was thinking about, you know, even going into a school, because I'm thinking, well, what are schools doing right now? I mean, they've removed, you know, some of the basic, what do they call it, ICT training, which was like, oh, how to use Word and that sort of thing. You know, and I think about what my daughter's doing in school with GCSEs, and some of it really is, we're here, you know, learn all these acts from 1280 Magna Carta all the way up to the creation of the UN. And you're like, why would you do that? I mean, it's useful to know, but then, you know, you've got to get the date right. The world isn't like that anymore. You want to get a date of something, you go and ask Google or whatever assistant you've got. But asking that assistant to build you something, iterating on that and working with it to produce something that's truly yours, you know, there's a skill in that, and it's a skill which everyone is going to need more and more.
Well, it's an interesting, I think, a really important point that you're touching on there. So I'm not going to get into bloody schools, right? Maybe another day, but it is so depressing. And most kids learn much more from YouTube than they do from they're probably very knowledgeable and really caring teachers, but that's definitely for another day. What this type of approach really does is, if you're like me, I don't learn linearly, right? So if you get a course on something, or you buy a book on anything really, but, you know, a programming language, it tends to take you from first principles, you know, in a very sort of linear, logical, stepwise way. And I don't have that level of patience. I just want to start doing. I learn by doing. I don't remember things. I've got my ability to store information when I need to is almost non-existent. It's an ADHD thing, right? I've got no attention span. So I tend to learn by doing. I just dive in, right? So I'll find out the bare minimum I need to know about something and then just start doing it and start making mistakes. And then I'll go back to my source material and go, right, then how do I do this? How do I do that? Right. So I'll jump in the middle. I want to be creating things immediately. Don't tell me to write Hello World. I don't give a crap. And this really works for me because you can just go in at any point and you can say, right, okay, build me snakes in Python, you know, the game Snake or whatever it's called. And then go in and say, right, now step me through what this is doing. Instead of that, can you do it so that now you've got random extra obstacles around the screen that you have to avoid, right? And if you hit it, your snake gets chopped in half, right? And so I want you to make that change, but I want you to guide me through how you're doing it, right? So I've already got a game that I can be playing with. I can add to it, and then I can get straight deep into the code. And if it's the point where I have to say, Adam, what's a variable? You know what I mean? And, you know, what does an if statement do? Then so fine, whatever. It's going to take a while to make that change. It's going to take a while for us to step through that code. But I'm already working on something. And for me, you know, getting from A to B so much quicker, it really works for the way that I was already doing things. And it really, really accelerates the way that I like to learn. And I think there's a lot of kids and adults out there that are like me who don't think linearly. And also I have other things like they think visually rather than via sort of, you know, linear or word-based stuff. There's people who are dyslexic, you name it, right? That just don't learn in the same way and really struggle in school, in education, struggle to learn things because everything is designed for this middle ground group of people who do think and learn linearly and need to be told things, right? And I think the world is a much harder place for people like me until you find stuff like this that allows you to define how you want to learn and learn that way, right? And I think that is going to be a revolution. Right, for learning. Quite how schools adapt to that is anyone's guess. My guess is, at least in the short term, medium term, they won't. They'll ignore it. But I think, there's a whole bunch of kids who are like me at school that are going to figure this out and really start to accelerate ahead of their linear thinking peers simply because they found a way of learning that makes sense to them.
Well, and the flip side of that is because I'm much more of a linear learner to an extent. And the flip side is, I'm not massively extreme in that, I'm adaptable and flexible to an extent, but I know there are people way the other side. And so they'll look at something like this. They'll say, if I don't want to do anything because it might break, I don't know what it's doing. I'm confused. I don't want to ask it stuff. I'm a bit worried, and I can see people like that somewhat being left behind because they kind of don't want to press the key. I mean, maybe I'm wrong there, but I can see this plays into somebody that's going, oh, right, I can imagine something and then it's there. But other people going, well, I don't know what to imagine. And, I need to understand first. You know what I mean? So it's interesting. And we should probably look into learning styles and see what this might benefit and what it might not benefit so much. Who might struggle with it?
Ultimately, I talk about it as if, oh, this is made for people like me. But if you are that person, and I know people like this who need guiding, they almost need permission to do every step. But then tell the model to do that, right? I almost think they might find themselves in a better place simply because it's all there in front of them. They can see the effects of the things they're doing. They can go for it at their own speed. They might have found the book alternative, the manual, either overly wordy or wasn't getting to the right points or was jumping around too much. And so, this methodology might work way better for them, just saying, no, I need you to step through it exactly like this. And no, stop, you're going too fast. Let's go back to that. And and sort of in an environment that's fairly safe. And you know, I struggle to see how you wouldn't be able to conjure up a sort of assistant, as it were, that can't work in the style that you want to work. I mean, I'm sure I can be knocked down on that.
Yeah.
But it does feel like, you know, everybody should be at least trying this.
Yeah. I mean, there's going to be a limitation there, but I think that flexibility is key because, and also if you compare that with the past, you can see how, you know, there's a real juxtaposition there, which is like you say, well, I'll pick up a book. I've got this book to learn from. If that book doesn't get into my mentality, and we all do this, because what do you end up doing? You end up buying another book because the one you got on Pandas, well, I got the basics in it, but then it started going out and it wasn't there. And then this other book I recommend to everyone. Well, why? Well, because the way that the author approached it is what sat well with your brain. Now, of course, you take that to things like schools. Well, you have much less flexibility. Here's the curriculum. Here's how we're going to teach you. Oh, but I'm not very good at learning that. I don't get it, miss. Well, tough, you know. And like you say, whereas now you've got this teacher in the LLMs where you can go, well, I don't get it that way. Can you give it another way? It does not care that you might have just insulted it, its whole learning and the 5 years it spent at uni learning this stuff. And it'll go, okay, I'll try and give that to you in another way. And say, well, I don't get that either. Can you take it back to basics, or can you talk about it like in a Star Wars manner so that I could get the universe, you know? You could use any sort of metaphor and it's going to try and pull something out of the bag for you. And like you say, that flexibility, I think, is really where
everyone's going to be having stuff taught to them in Cthulhu incantations. But I think obviously any teachers listening to this, any school teachers will be screaming into the void while we poison their ears with this. And I worry, of course, that taking that point of view to too much of its logical extreme is just as dangerous. You know, kids need contact, they need guidance, they need safety, they need an environment where they can have their own working style, but they can do so without, you know, risking, you know, hallucinations, poisonous messaging, all this sort of stuff. And I sort of feel like, I you know, we're getting into really dangerous territory here, but there has to be a human input. Yes. But is it then the teacher's really understanding, you know, being given an environment that is inherently safe, attaching to models that they can rely on, that fact check and don't, you know, try and groom kids or whatever it is, nasty crap they're doing, you know, turn them into racists or whatever. But then it's for the teacher and the child to work together to try and get the machine to understand their style of working and then be there for them as a coach and an assistant, as the human, and just make sure that they're getting what they need from it. And this point, you're there to shepherd them and make sure that they are learning. And if they're not learning, well, why? Is your assistant wrong for you? Or is there something else going on here, right? Am I making you read everything, but it turns out you're dyslexic, right? And so all I needed to do was have it, you know, speak to you as opposed to write things, right? All of these things I can see as a possibility, but we have to not get into this realm where, oh no, kids don't need to go to school. They just need a terminal and that's plugged into an LLM, because that would be more disastrous than the current situation.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just as you spoke there, I mean, it's just, you know, these things are assistants and they should remain as such. And, you know, and I'm sure, like you say, you know, not to, don't want to be denigrating anyone's profession. Surely, you know, teachers going, but yeah, it'd be so good to have help. You know, something like this. Yeah, and again, it's that shift from the past of, well, what I'm teaching you is do it this way. You know, and I know there's been a lot of change in the last 50 years, more to, you know, focusing in results. And I certainly know my daughter, when she was learning in primary school, And it was like, when I learned, it was like, you do maths like this, here's how you do long division. Oh, can't you do it like this? No, you do it this way and this way only. Whereas she was taught three or four different ways to do it. You know, you can do it this way and this way. And in fact, you know, you're sort of challenged to try several and do the one that works best for you. And that seems to have come through into some of the secondary school maths and stuff. It's a lot more flexible than it used to be because there's a slightly different focus there. You've got to learn it. But you don't just have to do this way and this way only. And, you know, an assistance with different ways of learning just going to help with that, right? You know, it's that focus, you know, like in work, not the focus on the work that people are doing, but on the results that they get.
Well, quite. And just as when people are trying to teach me maths at school, I was like, why am I doing this when calculators exist? You know, there's going to be a bit of why am I doing this when, you know, ChatGPT exists? And I can just get on either side of this argument because both sides are equally valid. And it's not really an argument, I guess, is why that is the case. It's a, you know, the world has moved on and we just have to figure out a way of accommodating it without, you know, selling the souls of our children. And I don't think any of us really want to do that. But I really suffered at school because I'm ADHD, autistic, dyslexic, and various other things too. I was an odd, awkward teenager, and I was in the remedial classes. Now, you know, I'm not here to tell you I'm the next Einstein, but most people would credit me with being quite smart. But at school, they thought I was, you know, there was something really, you know, I really was considered a no-hoper. But I was also the youngest in my year, right? I was an August baby, which in the UK means that, you know, you're at the tail end. So I was, you know, less mature as well as being a slow development because of my autism, all this stuff. School was a nightmare for me. I really believe in this stuff as part of the solution, but it can only be ever that.
Totally. Well, we've spilled on quite long there. Not bad for a bit of vibe.
Yeah, but what's a bit of vibe bantering, right?
Indeed.
Yeah, we were going to go on for something for you, Pete, but I think we might be running up against time.
We'll do that another
day. Yeah, well, actually, I think your dog leg into education, as thorny a territory it is, there really be dragons there, I think was a really interesting impromptu digression, so we'll take that. We will come back to the stuff that we were going to do for you next week, probably. But you never know with us because we're so bloody capricious. We've got an interview coming up, we hope, that we should be conducting in the next day or two. Our first interview. So let's see how that goes. I'm not going to give any more details or spoilers or anything because there's a reasonable chance it just won't happen. So, or that it does happen and it's utter chaos given the person that we're interviewing. So, you'll have to watch this space. And if it does turn into utter chaos, I'll at least try and, you know, exert some of it because at the very least it'll be a laugh, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Right. Good. Well, good to talk, Pete. We'll see everyone soon.
Yeah. See you all next time. All right. Cheers.
The confusion matrix.